Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in H.L. and others against Matheson, the governor of Utah. I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The question before the Court today involves the validity of a Utah statute which provides that before an abortion may be provided to a minor, her parents must be notified if it is physically possible to do so. The facts of the case involved a 15-year-old minor determined she was in her first trimester of an undesired pregnancy, spoke with her social worker, determined that she should terminate that pregnancy. She determined further that her parents should not be involved, then consulted her treating physician.
The social worker?
No, at this point, the woman herself contacted the doctor, and the doctor also had a social worker working with him. They consulted with her, determined with the social workers, the physicians, that her parents should not be notified.
Who made that determination?
That determination was made, Mr. Justice Stewart, by the woman, the doctor, and the social workers. All of them felt that the parents should not be involved.
Where in the record, counsel, is the finding or testimony that the doctor felt the parents should not be consulted?
Okay, that is in the complaint, and that was part of her testimony she testified.
Could you cite the pages?
I can only refer the Court to the transcript of at the beginning.
I read the transcript. The physician felt he could not do it without consulting the parents, but I didn't read the transcript to find any place that he felt it was in her best interest that the parents not be consulted.
Wasn't it a matter of notice to the parents rather than consulting the parents?
Yes, it is a matter of notice rather than consultation. And if I said consultation, I misspoke myself, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. It's a question of that they should not be given notice of it.
Where in the transcript or findings do you find anything that the physician thought it was contrary to her best medical interest that her parents not be notified?
That's what he told her.
Where in what we have before us?
I believe that is in her testimony. I was looking at it. It is definitely testified by her that her counselor, and I'm looking in the pages 24 through 26.
Appendix?
Of the appendix, Mr. Chief Justice. And she said that she should go ahead without notifying.
Could you give us the verbatim?
I am looking now at her testimony, and I'm going down page 25. You consulted with a counselor that you were pregnant or about the pregnancy. Yeah. You determined after talking to the counselor that you should get an abortion. Yes. You felt you did not want to notify your parents. Right, of that decision. You did not feel, for your own reasons, you could discuss it with them. Right. After discussing the matter with your counselor, you still believed you should not discuss it with your parents. Right. And that they should not be notified. Right. After talking the matter over with your counselor, and the counselor concurred in your decision that your parents should not be notified. Right. You were notified, you were advised that an abortion could not be performed without notifying them. Yes. You came to see me about filing the suit. Yes. You and I then discussed as to whether or not you had a right to do what you wanted to do. Yes. You decided after our discussion you should still proceed with the action to try to obtain an abortion without notifying your parents. Right. Now, at the time you signed the complaint and spoke with the counselor and with me, You're in the first trimester of pregnancy within your first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Yes. You feel that from talking to the counselor and thinking the situation over and discussing it with me that you could make the decision on your own that you wish to abort the pregnancy. Yes. Then it goes on to say you were living at home.
Mr. Tolowitz, is that you testifying on...
I'm asking the questions she is answering right.
That's all she said is yes.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I may say so, I led her through this very carefully. And the reason that I did that is she had a highly unique fact situation. And as you can, as you read through the appendix, you saw that this examination took place after the court had already denied a preliminary injunction and had ruled that the peculiar facts in her circumstance made no difference. It was the only question under the Utah statute the trial judge felt was whether it was physically possible to notify her, because then, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, after this, you see there's about 10 pages of colloquy between the court and myself.
Any of what you have read from the trial judge so far supports a finding that her doctor told her that it was not in her best medical interest to get an abortion?
In terms of the record, it does not. Now, what happened there is I forgot to ask her that question.
Well,
because I've spoken with the doctor myself, and the doctor told her that, and I've talked to her.
In your statement of the case, in your brief, Mr. Tolowitz, you say, in consultation with both her physician and social worker, she determined that it was in her best medical interest that she be aborted and that her parents not be notified of either her decision or its implementation.
I do, sir, and that is the
that's
finding.
That's a fair paraphrase of what you read us, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Justice Stewart. And that is the finding of the court, of the trial court.
It is not a finding that the doctor told her it was against her best interest.
Okay. It is a finding, I believe. And I, at this point, would have to refer the trial court, or this court, Your Honor, to the specific findings, conclusions of law. And in the findings that I'm referring to, I am looking at, I'm looking at page 40, finding 7 of the findings of fact, page 40 of the appendix, where the trial court made the determination that she should be aborted and that he felt, that's the doctor, that it was not in her best medical interest to do so, or it was in her best medical interest to do so, but could not and would not perform an abortion on her without informing her parents prior to aborting her because of the statute.
Mr. Tolowitz, you have emphasized in your oral argument, you've spent quite a bit of time on it and our questions, and you did in the examination, direct examination of your witness, the importance, you have emphasized the importance of getting counsel and advice and assistance, lawyers, social workers, doctors. And you rest on the fact that she had the advice and counsel of all these people.
Yes, Mr. Chief.
What if she had the advice of no one, just walked in off the street and said, I want to have an abortion, and the doctor said, not unless I notify the parents. No other factors. Would the case be any different from the points that you have
factually
brought here?
It would, Your Honor.
Factually, it would.
Legally, in terms of the position I'm taking today, I'm speculating. I would say no.
And you don't need to speculate on that, do you?
Hmm?
You don't need to speculate on the Constitution question, do you?
No.
It would make no difference, would it?
No. If she has the right of privacy to go ahead on her own, then she has that right.
Now, she's 15 years old, isn't
she? That's correct.
Suppose she were 12. Same?
I would assume. Well, the problem, Your Honor, is I move to speculation, and I move to it in a very difficult area, and that is the level of maturity is such that at a 12-year-old, she could be very mature, totally immature, but we're leaving something out, and that is that she is talking to a doctor and said, I want an abortion. But you're leaving out that the state has already said who's going to practice medicine and what are reasonable standards. And the physician is going to say, I have a right to make a decision whether it's in your best medical interest, and I'm not going to take an action which is in opposition to your best medical interest. And if the 12-year-old that you have asked me about, the doctor feels cannot rationally make that decision, in her own best interest.
What about 10 years of age?
I would give you the same answer. I think that you're dealing with a doctor-patient decision where the doctor, who the state has said is licensed to practice medicine, should be able to deal with his patient and the minor and deal without the outside influences, talk to that patient and say, at the end of that discussion, I'm not going to do this without your parents. I'm going to do this with your parents.
In Utah, under Utah law, if she'd walked in, a girl, 10, 11, 12, 15, whatever, and said, I want my tonsils taken out, but my parents won't send me to a doctor and won't agree to it, would the doctor be legally permitted to perform the tonsillectomy?
Okay. There is no law that prohibits it, but I believe that most physicians would not do it.
Because and of the possibility of a malpractice suit, among other things,
yes,
I suppose.
Sir, there is a difference, though, and that is the decision of this court in Danforth and Bellotti II and a statute of the state of Utah which states that a minor of any age can consent to any treatment regarding pregnancy.
Mr. Dolowitz, would you straighten me out? I want to be sure about this. On page 25 of the appendix, do you have it in front of you?
Yes, Mr. Justice Black.
Down just below the middle, there's a question. After talking the matter over with a counselor, the counselor concurred in your decision that your parents should be notified, is what it says. Now, when you read it, you put a not in there.
Okay.
Should the not be in there?
It should have been, because if it wasn't, then I misspoke it at the time. Because it was very clear all the way through, from the time that she came in, that she had spoken to her counselor, she'd spoken to her counselors and her physician before she came to me, and that they all felt that this was a very unique situation, and she should not, her parents simply shouldn't be notified.
All I want to know is whether you and opposing counsel agree that this is an error in the printing of the transcript, that the not is in there.
Yes, I agree, Mr. Justice Black.
Thank you.
Now, Your Honor, what we're dealing with, as you can see, I realize from your questions, Mr. Chief Justice, that you're very concerned about the age of the woman involved. The problem is that I think that Utah has overstepped in doing that by saying that a parent must be notified in every case, because just as I answered to you, that the physician must be involved in making that decision.
Well, then are you saying that the statute might be constitutional if it fixed the limit at age 12 or 14?
No, Your Honor, I would not. I would say unconstitutional if it did that. But if it said that the physician, if the words, if possible, and this, in fact, is I urge on the Utah Supreme Court, the language, if possible, should be construed to mean if medically appropriate. That if the doctor, in consultation with his patient, feels that the parents should be notified, consulted, brought in, however that's to be phrased, that would be a rational statute.
Could that phrase not also be intended to take into account a child who had been abandoned by her parents, didn't know where her parents were, parents impossible to reach, that sort of thing?
Yes, and
isn't that what the statute is aimed at?
Your Honor, the answer I'm going to say is that that might have been the intention, and the Utah Supreme Court said, if possible, within a rational time, and the problem is that makes it very vague as to precisely what it means, and the problem that then comes from that is if you say, well, you know, if physically possible, like if they're on a trip, if they're somewhere else, you still have the same problem. But what happens if they're on the trip, but you have a social worker or a doctor who knows that family and says, gee, I'm glad they're on that trip. It is best not to notify them. But what happens when they're in town and he still feels it's best not to notify them? Now, I can explain the reasons why that is good. I think Mr. Justice Powell in the Bellotti II decision gave a very careful description of the reasons why a parent should not be notified. I think there's a tendency to mix up the concepts of notification and consultation, assuming that if you notify the parent, you're going to bring them into consultation, but that isn't always true, that you bring parents in, and frequently you bring them in, and have the result that will cause more trouble if it's an abusive parent, if it's a parent who for religious reasons doesn't agree, They will impose their values on the child. On that case, this is the problem with the statute. Instead of being able to respond to the very particularized questions you asked me, Mr. Chief Justice, this is a broad, it's an all-inclusive statute. It disregarded the concerns that this Court has stated that in this area, a statute that's drawn should be drawn very narrowly, very carefully, and consider the interests of the minor. Because you asked me about a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, that's not what I'm talking about. Those are some of the circumstances. But Utah doesn't take any consideration into that. H.L., you asked me when we started about a lot of the facts in this case. There's also another case that was filed between the decision of the Utah Supreme Court and the granting or the taking of jurisdiction by this court in this case. It was filed in the United States District Court for the District of Utah. In that case, four women have been granted injunctions and allowed to obtain abortions by the determination of the trial judge in that case that they were mature minors, handling their own affairs. One of them had another child who, on their own, could make the decision, and in fact it would be detrimental to them to have their parents notified.
Those four plaintiffs were all emancipated, were they not?
Three of the four were. One was still living at home. Then, and I've lodged the papers with the clerk's office if the court wishes to pursue that, so that the findings, the conclusions, the orders in each of those four cases, the first one is included as an appendix to my brief. The other three I've lodged with the clerk's office. Now, in each of those cases, they were mature minors, and the trial judge, Judge Jenkins, determined that it would be detrimental to the parent-child relationship to notify the parents. In some cases, because there had been a split. That's why the child had left. Things were getting better. That would be broken up. I mean, these are just illustrations as to the overbreadth of this statute. Then there's a second set of problems that come up, and that is the doctor-patient relationship has been invaded by this statute.
Well, before you leave those other cases, I don't understand their relevance to the issue presented by this case.
The relevance, Mr. Justice Stevens, tends to come from the observations of Mr. Justice Powell in the second Bilotti decision, and that is that as applied to two, I will call them categories of minors.
Well, let's say the statute's unconstitutional as applied to a lot of people who are not before the court. Right. Let's assume that. Okay. How does that help you in this case?
Okay. In this case, we're dealing with a subgroup of a minor where the determination had been made by the social worker, the physician, that it was not in her best interest. And the trial court...
I thought you just agreed with Mr. Justice Rehnquist that there was no such determination. The child so determined, after consultation with the doctor and the social worker.
If I said that, then that was not what I meant. I think the determination was made by the social workers, by the doctor, by the woman.
You don't suggest anything that you say in the read from the transcript said the doctor...
Okay.
Said it was not in her best interest to notify the parent.
Nothing that I read said that, and that means that when I asked the questions in the trial, I stopped one question too soon. Because
we review questions or cases on transcripts, not on unasked questions.
I realize that, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, and one of the problems that was going on in this case was from the prior determination of the trial judge, that the only question that he considered important is, was it physically possible to locate the parents, meant that I was conducting that hearing with her to simply show that the facts alleged in the complaint were in fact correct. And then when we got into the questions, if you see, Mr. McCarthy asked her the question of, you feel you can't discuss this with your parents, and she said, right. And said, you feel you can't discuss other problems with your parents? She said, right. And he said, what other problems? And at that point, I objected. We went from there around to the question that if the only issue, as far as the Utah trial court was concerned, was it in her best interest, was it possible to physically locate her parents?
Nothing in the record about that here. Have you got something in the record about giving notice?
Okay, I have that she did not want to give notice to her parents.
No. The possibility, the capability, the feasibility of writing letters to parents.
Okay, no. But there was no question in terms of my representations to the judge, the discussion, as far as Mr. Tinker and Mr. McCarthy were concerned, which she could. Physically, her parents could be located, and I believe Mr. McCarthy asked her those questions, and that she responded that they could, that she went... and again, I think we're going on just past that, where Mr. McCarthy is asking the questions. He said, "Are you still living at home? Are you dependent on your parents?" This, now, again, this may be an error. I may have been too protective of her in the trial, but there is no question that her parents could have been readily notified. And I'm not raising.
Had the doctor written a letter? Simply stating the simple, direct fact that your daughter has come to me to have an abortion performed, and I'm prepared to do it, and under the statute I'm giving you notice that I will proceed with this procedure 7 days from today. Would he have complied with the statute?
Yes. He would have. But she did
not. I'm not sure you've answered my earlier question about whether there would, it affects your case one way or the other, it would affect it one way or the other, if there had been no consultation with anyone. The girl, 10, 12, 14, 15, walked in off the street and said, "I want the abortion," and the doctor said, "All right, I'll give the notice," or "I won't give the notice." Is the counseling of any relevance here to the constitutional question?
I believe it is not. When I answer that, Mr. Chief Justice, I answer that knowing that a number of the members of this court have expressed themselves in these opinions that you believe that it's a wise policy to encourage the family and to some way get the families together so that counseling occurs, so that I say that with some degree of trepidation when I say no, but I say it with the knowledge that she is initially going to someone who the state of Utah has licensed as a physician and said that to this regard, you have to counsel. So in this way, where I'm saying that there may not be mandatory counseling in that sense. That you're asking me, does the fact that she had that counseling make it any different than if she had just walked into the doctor? And to the constitutional issue, I say no. Because this statute mandates it in all cases. But I say that with the knowledge that you have, that at least a number of members of this court feel that there should be some counseling, and I say that it in fact exists because the physicians provide it. And a physician is not in a position where he is going to simply go ahead and perform it without that type of counseling, without knowing that, if you want to call it this way, his license is at risk, his malpractice insurance is at risk. If he commits a malpractice or a violation of the licensing statutes, and in fact, that same protection is insidiously, I think, undermined in this case, because it moves in, and if a doctor is in a situation where the minor who comes in and they sit down, no counselors, no social workers at all, and the counseling takes place one-to-one, and the doctor said, "You should be aborted. Your parents should not be notified in my best medical judgment, but I can't do it because of this statute."
Well, Mr. Dalowitz, I think you referred us to this finding 7, didn't you, page 40?
Yes, sir.
Now,
yes, Mr. Justice Breyer.
Am I to read that finding as you have just stated the proposition, that after consultation, or rather, when consulting with her physician, he advised her that she should be aborted, that he was unwilling to perform an abortion without complying with the provisions of the statute, even though he believed it was best to do so. But to perform the abortion without complying with the statute, is that the way we're supposed to read that?
Yes, he was not willing to
Is that the way you want us to read that?
I want you to read that as saying that he felt in his best medical judgment, one, an abortion should be performed. Secondly, that her parents should not be notified. Third, that he was not willing to act on his best medical judgment, which was to abort her without notifying her parents because he was at criminal risk if he did so.
And that's what we read into, even though he believed it was best to do so.
And so
it's a very ambiguous finding, isn't it? Okay. If you read it with all the nuances that Mr. Justice Brennan puts in it.
That, what I have just expressed to you is what was intended to do that, and if we were not, if between the trial judge and counsel, we were not able to articulate it.
Did you submit the findings?
Yes.
Did you draft the findings?
I drafted the findings, Mr. Justice White.
Were they entered exactly as you drew them?
They were after dispute. In other words, the state submitted its set. Mr. Tinker, Mr. McCarthy. That's correct.
Verbatim.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Dolowitz, does the record, in fact, show whether she was aborted?
The record does not show that, sir. The what I'm trying to indicate to Mr. Justice White in responding is that both of us submitted the findings, then Judge Winder asked us both to come in, and we talked, and Mr. Tinker and I both communicated with him, and if you'll note that hearing occurred in, I believe, April or May, and the entry did not occur until, I think it's November or December. And a big part of that was the question over the findings, getting a transcript made and going back over the questions that had been presented. Unless the court has further questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Very well, Mr. Dolowitz. Mr. Tinker.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, by enacting the statute which is at issue here, the parents in the state of Utah, and after all, it's parents who are of voting age and who are represented in the Utah legislature, have essentially said something to the effect as follows. Yes, we recognize that it is not possible under the Constitution for us to exercise any kind of absolute veto or place a roadblock, an absolute roadblock, in the way of our minor daughter who is living at home and who may seek to have an abortion. And it should be noted that we've conceded this even in as early as 1974, which is when this statute was enacted, which precedes both the Danforth decision and the first Bilotti decision. But even if we may not veto the decision of our minor daughter living at home who chooses to have an abortion, we at least want to know about it.
Does the statute refer to living at home?
No, the statute on its face.
Then why are you putting those words in your description of the statute?
Merely for emphasis in that is who the statute is primarily intended to control. The statute speaks in terms of minors, Mr. Justice Blackmun.
Yes, but how do we know that? There are many emancipated minors, even in Utah, I would assume.
Well, and I think that is precisely the separate question which is raised by this other case that Mr. Dolowitz has referred to and which Mr. Justice Stevens has questioned the relevance here. I would suggest to this Court that the question of the emancipated minor is not before this Court, is not part of this record. It is.
The statute does not refer to an emancipated minor or an unemancipated one.
That's true.
I'd like to look at the case in the face of your statute.
Right. And the statute on its face describes only minors. And my suggestion, which I don't think is entirely relevant in this case, but is clearly the heart of this other case that is still pending, is whether under Utah law, as a matter of construction of Utah law, that term minor includes emancipated minors.
Well, do you think that a minor still living at home can challenge the statute that Mr. Justice Blackmun just described, which does not limit it that way? Does she have standing?
Does the minor not living at home have standing?
Does the minor living at home have standing to challenge the statute on the ground that it's overbroad as to minors who are not living at home?
No, I don't think that minor has that standing, and I don't think that's the case presented here at all. The case presented here is a minor, 15 years old, living at home, challenging the statute as it applies to her. I don't think there's any reasonable question that can be raised that it was intended to apply to her. There can be a question raised, I think, as to whether it was intended to apply to the emancipated minor.
She's challenging the statute on its face, not as it applies to her, isn't she?
And for class.
Well, yes, she
now
is
somebody else, an emancipated. Let's assume that the Supreme Court of your state has already decided that the statute on its face is constitutional. On the other hand, the federal court out in your state has decided that as applied to an emancipated minor, the statute, if it does apply to an emancipated minor, is unconstitutional.
That's correct, Mr. Justice Stewart.
She's not. And in this case, the statute is not being challenged as applied, but it's simply being challenged on its face, isn't it?
Yes. But I would see the facial challenge as being substantially different if there were an authoritative construction of the statute that said it cannot, by virtue of state law, apply to emancipated minors.
What is a minor in Utah?
Under 18, unless married. Minors achieve their majority under Utah law if they are married.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, not till 18. Now, that's by statutory law.
Therefore, this statute could be, its constitutional validity could be attacked by, as it applies to people over 17, for example.
Yes.
But here it's being attacked on its face.
By a 15-year-old who it
who
clearly
is living at home.
Does apply to, yes.
Do you see any inherent conflict between the federal court case and this one?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, I do not. The federal trial court judge has taken pains in his findings to differentiate between what the Utah Supreme Court found. He has felt that decision is binding as far as state law is concerned, so far as it goes, and he sees this as presenting a different class and a different issue. That's why I suggest that case is irrelevant in this case as it presently stands before this court.
But Mr. Tinker, the class described in the complaint, and as I understand the trial judge, he did sort of, in effect, say the class was proper, includes all minor women who are suffering unwanted pregnancies and desire to terminate them, which would include the emancipated minors as well as the unemancipated. I'm looking at page 5 of the appendix. And didn't the there's nothing in the Supreme Court of Utah's opinion. It says that we are only deciding the question presented by the named plaintiff as opposed to the class as a whole, which had been certified.
But I'm not sure, Mr. Justice Stevens, that alone, the fact that the class was not defined to exclude all these others, permits the named plaintiff to represent a class that she's not part of.
Except as a matter of state law, the state judge said she's an adequate representative, and his reasoning would apply equally to emancipated or unemancipated, and the reasoning of the Utah Supreme Court would apply equally to both. Now, maybe the federal cases are different, but it seems to me if you have a class which, as a matter of state law, includes emancipated minors, and the Supreme Court of the state disposed of the case on the assumption that they were all before the court, we have that issue, and I don't know why we shouldn't decide it.
Well, unless as a matter of federal constitutional law, a particular plaintiff doesn't have standing to make a particular argument.
That's right. And the trial judge did confine it, as I read his opinion on page 14, the last part of it, under the facts involved here, where the woman in question is age 15, unmarried, resides at home with her parents, and is dependent upon them for support, and where the identity of the parents is either known to the physician or easily ascertainable by him. He did indicate that his reasoning, at least, was confined to the facts of this case in upholding the facial constitutionality of the statute, which is all that he did and all the Supreme Court of Utah did.
Well, at least there was no discussion.
That he certified the class. That was in his order denying the temporary injunction. Didn't he thereafter accept the class definition?
Well, I think the class was essentially defined at that preliminary stage and was not changed in the subsequent proceedings. Let me suggest further what the legislature of the state of Utah was doing. They're saying that with respect to minors generally, we as parents forego any claim to being able to veto an abortion decision. But if there is to be an abortion performed, we simply want notice of it.
A little due process for the parents, is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Mr. Chief Justice. We want to know about it. We would ideally like to have some input, perhaps some consultation, but even by this statute, we do not mandate that. The statute on its face could be satisfied, as one of the briefs has suggested, by a mere telephone call at a certain point prior to the performance of the abortion, advising that the abortion will take place. That might not be an entirely satisfactory kind of performance under the statute, but it would be sufficient, I think, to preclude any criminal penalty upon the doctor. The parents are...
And what does that accomplish? Does that enable the physician to exercise his best medical judgment a little better?
Among other things, he may, Mr. Justice Blackmun, obtain additional information that he might not know in the case of a girl of tender years by talking with her parents.
And yet the statute doesn't go that far with respect to parents if the child is married, even though her husband is 16.
No, it does not take into account that particular situation. Parents are saying we not only want a little due process, but they're saying we would like to enhance the full range of choices that our daughter may have in this matter. We recognize that the trend of things, if you will, in our society is very much in the direction that abortion will be viewed by a great many people, especially the professionals, the counselors, the doctors, and so forth, as the option of choice in this situation. In some cases, we may, if we had the chance, merely like to give another viewpoint there. Not that our viewpoint could be binding by any means, and not even that the statute requires the consultation, but merely that the doctor must give the opportunity for the parents to know, and then it essentially becomes the doctor's own problem as a matter of ethics. It's really thrown back in entirely into the private sector without the state being involved.
Is it possible that the legislature had in mind that, or is it possible that it's inherent in the case that the parents might be able to give something of the medical history and background of the child that would be relevant to the doctor and his decision?
Well, the Utah Supreme Court, in its unanimous decision, made that specific finding that would be one of the purposes. I don't think that's the only purpose, but I think that is a very significant one.
I'm not quite clear what it is you say would satisfy the requirement of notification. Suppose he's about ready to perform the abortion, but before he does, he picks up the telephone. He gets hold of the mother of the girl. He said, I have your daughter here. I'm about to perform an abortion. Goodbye. Does that do it?
I'm afraid it does, Mr. Justice Brennan, on the face of the statute. As I say, I don't...
Then how much input does this contemplate that the parents will have?
Well, it contemplates, I think, only as much as the doctor in his professional judgment will permit. But I think most doctors, given the requirement that they must go at least that far, will at least be willing to hear a few things. Now, this gets us off into speculation again.
But I just want to be clear. They don't have to. The statute doesn't require them.
Clearly not.
Go beyond what I suggested.
Clearly not.
What if the mother in that hypothetical case then said, are you aware, doctor, that our daughter has been under psychiatric care for the last 7 years, and the doctor says, no, I'm not aware of it. Is that something he merely must apply to his medical decision?
I think he has.
At all.
Excuse me. I think he has a professional obligation to then take that knowledge into account. Again, the law of the state of Utah probably does not compel him to do that unless it were so egregious that it became a matter of malpractice. And in that respect, the statute may tend to protect the doctor.
Well, that might mean, among other things, that the minor patient was not capable of giving consent to anything, a tonsillectomy, an appendectomy, or an abortion. Might it not?
It could be. You have an interesting kind of overlap, in my view, of legal disabilities that are occasioned simply by minority and legal disabilities that are occasioned by absolute lack of competency, mental type lack of competency. You might have those overlapping, fitting in the same situation here. I think the teachings of this court have been that as far as those disabilities which occur simply because of lack of majority status are somewhat tempered, somewhat moderated or modified when you're in the abortion context or in the other contexts regarding the ability to procreate. But there you get into a very difficult situation when you bring both of them in, and again, you have a difficult kind of balancing problem.
Mr. Tinker?
Yes, Mr. Justice Powell.
In the plurality opinion in Bilotti 2, we said this with respect to notice. We conclude that every minor must have the opportunity, if she so desires, to go directly to a court without first consulting or notifying her parents. How do you construe that language, granted, of course, that it is a part of a plurality opinion?
I construe that language as relating to the situation of the Massachusetts statute, which was a consent statute, not a mere notice statute like ours, and which already created the possibility of alternatives. The question of notice, which is presented in what I would suggest is a pure form in our particular case because of the nature of the statute, was presented in a much more complicated scheme in the Massachusetts case.
There was an alternative in Massachusetts, the court. There, no alternative in Utah.
Right, but the reason there was an alternative in Massachusetts was that there was consent required. You had to get consent from somebody. In Utah, you don't have to get consent from anybody.
I have that. I haven't read it recently, but I had thought that the purpose of the constitutional requirement that that the plaintiff, pregnant, unmarried female, be allowed to go to a court was to convince that court that she was a mature minor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no claim here, is there, that the plaintiff is a mature minor?
Not in the pleadings of this case or in the records.
It's not that she's an immature minor.
I'm sorry?
Do you assume she's an immature minor?
I believe so. I don't know finding to the contrary.
No claim at all that she's a mature minor or was prohibited or prevented from showing a court that she was?
No. In Utah, we don't have a specific procedure for showing a court of this.
There wasn't in the Massachusetts legislation either, and that's what we found constitutionally deficient, as I remember.
Well, my recollection was that the Massachusetts statute provided that if a parent refused to give consent or was unavailable, that you could then repair to the Court of General Jurisdiction and seek an order granting the consent in place of the parent.
Despite the failure to give consent. But the court held, as I remember it, that the minor should be permitted to go to the court for a determination that she was a mature minor and that no effort to get consent was required. But now, as I understand it, in the present case, which doesn't, of course, involve consent, but rather notice alone, there is no claim that the plaintiff was a mature minor and or that she was prevented from going to a court to show that she was. Is there?
I don't believe there is such a claim, Mr. Justice Stewart.
Mr. Tinker, may I ask on this subject? I think the record is a little unclear because Justice Stewart has correctly pointed out the trial judge did emphasize the specific facts here in denying the injunction. But then later on there's reference to the class she purports to represent. So I have some doubt as to whether the mature minor or emancipated minor issue is here, but assume for the moment it is, and recognizing that the point is not clear. What is the position of the state of Utah? A, does the statute apply to the emancipated minor? And secondly, is the statute then constitutional?
That's sort of the horns of a dilemma, Mr. Justice Stevens, but the...
Under the district courts, holding the federal courts, the statute is unconstitutional as applied to emancipated minors.
If it applies, he essentially found in the alternative, either it does not apply to them, or if it does, it is unconstitutional as applied to them. And I don't disagree with the findings of the federal district court on that point.
That's a little ambiguous to me. On that point, he gave alternative findings.
Yes.
And now what is it you don't disagree with?
Well, that it either doesn't apply or that if it should be found to apply, it's unconstitutional with respect to both.
Law? First of all, do you have an opinion as a matter of state law as to whether it should be construed as a matter of state law to apply to emancipated minors?
Yes, I have an opinion, and my opinion is that it should be construed so as not to apply to an emancipated minor.
And is there any judicial authority in the state that has so construed the statute, other than federal judges, any state judges?
No. It has not been before state courts for that kind of an interpretation. Interestingly enough, in contrast to the many abortion kinds of statutes which have been so severely restricted and have been attacked even before they went into effect, this statute was in effect for about 4 years before it was even challenged on this parental notice issue. And this case that is presently before the court, and the other case that Mr. Dolowitz has supplied the information regarding, that's still pending in the federal district court, are the only two cases that I know of, and I'm sure they're the only two cases that exist.
Well, you're in effect saying the statute doesn't mean what it would appear to mean to an uninitiated reader, insofar as it excludes a class of minors which are not identified on the face of the statute. Does it also exclude a class of married women? I'm wondering if it's as broad in that area as it appears to be.
Well, I don't think it applies to married women at all, because in Utah, the statutory provision is that all minors achieve their majority by marriage.
No, but I'm talking about the requirement of notice to the husband of a married woman.
Oh, well, that I see that as a completely separate problem.
Well, if she's not a minor, there's no requirement of notification.
Right, but there another part of the statute, which is not before the court and not challenged here at all, requires notice to the husband, and that's what Mr. Justice Stevens is
whatever her age
is referring to. Yes, a married person
of whatever age.
If she's not a minor, there's no requirement of notification to her parents.
No. Oh, that's definitely correct.
And if she,
no
and if,
question that she's not mature. This one, there's no question, is there?
There's no question that she's not mature. No,
yes.
There's no question. Yeah.
Because if she were mature, she wouldn't be included under the statute, would she?
Well, no. I'm not say I did not say, Mr. Justice Marshall, that the fact that she was mature would take her out of the statute. The question of maturity in...
That's what I'm confused about, this marriage and maturity. You used it there, but you don't want to use it here.
Well,
you said it did take her out of the statute.
Marriage takes it out. I make a distinction. One class is married. They are out by operation of law. Another class is mature. Another category is emancipated. I don't believe that mature and emancipated in this context are coextensive categories.
Emancipated, you're referring to a young person who is married and therefore not a minor.
No. An emancipated minor is somebody living away from her parents and living independently, among other things.
Among other things.
And
unmarried.
Yes.
that person covered by the statute? I think I know your answer, but I'm...
Well, he said in his opinion it is or ought to be.
No, he said it was not covered by
not
the statute.
Not covered, but he said there's no state ruling on the subject.
Mr. Justice Stewart is correct in understanding me to this point on that issue.
I apologize. The statute does apply as a matter of state law, in your opinion, to such a person.
No, not to the emancipated
minor. But it's just a matter of his opinion in any event.
I understand that, but I just want to know what his opinion is. your opinion is, as a matter of state law, the statute does not apply to that person.
To the emancipated minor.
Unmarried, emancipated minor.
Correct. Living away from home, all the other things. One of the difficulties is determining what constitutes an emancipated minor. Right. I see a number of factors which go into that. A separate problem comes when you try to determine whether the minor is, quote, mature. I think that's a lesser standard, and a minor could be mature without being emancipated. The statute clearly takes in all minors who might be deemed mature, and this comes down merely to a question of legislative line drawing, in my view. The legislature had to make a category of who were included, and they took the standard definition of what constitutes the line between minority and majority, the age of 18.
And also maturity and immaturity?
Well, it's an arbitrary decision, in a sense, as to what constitutes.
Well, aren't you saying that, just think of that, if there's any maturity element in this case at all, it's in the use of the word minor to distinguish between those under 18 and over 18?
Yes, I am saying that, Mr. Justice.
In other words, you don't concede that someone might be 15 and mature.
Yes.
Oh, I concede that somebody might be, but there's nothing in this record to suggest that anyone is.
Well, there's nothing that suggests that this 15-year-old is not either, is there, in this record?
Yes.
Well, does not the action of the state legislature amount to a declaration that prima facie or presumptively a woman under the age of 18, if not emancipated, is too immature to make that decision, at least without notice to the parents.
At least without notice, but with no requirement that the parent can control the decision.
Well, then let me ask you again. Is that to say if there were evidence in this case that this 15-year-old was mature, then the statute would not apply?
No, I would not make that argument, sir. I would not suggest that.
But you do say if she were away from home, it would not apply.
Well, if she were away from home and if all the other factors, and this is what we've gone through before Judge Jenkins in the Federal District Court, is trying to find out whether a particular girl is emancipated or not. And he's taken into account where she was living, what her source of income was, whether she's living apart on her own volition or whether the parents had something to do with that.
The thing that puzzles me is how all those criteria can be found in this rather short statute, and you seem to agree they can.
Well, no, I'm saying...
You said if she's emancipated, the statute doesn't apply.
Yes,
those are all the things you look at
that,
to decide whether she's emancipated.
That an emancipated person is not, under terms of state law, a minor for purposes of the statute.
Did the state make any motion for the federal district court to abstain on the question of state law construction?
I have argued the abstention question in the LR case, and Judge Jenkins said that he would not abstain in this particular case because of the exigencies of time. The girl was near the end of the first trimester, nearing the point where the possibility of an abortion was complicated if it went longer, and he felt to send us back to state court would aggravate that situation, and so he refused to abstain. I still propose to ask Judge Jenkins to certify the question to the Utah Supreme Court of whether this precise question that I've been discussing with Mr. Justice Stevens of whether an emancipated minor is included in the statute at all.
Utah had one of those certification statutes.
I just found out recently that the Utah Supreme Court adopted by a minute entry, and it's not in their rules, but they've accepted one certification in the past, and they tell me they're willing to accept them.
Mr. Ticker, how old is this Utah statute?
The statute was passed in 1974. And that was the point that I thought was significant in that it came before Danforth, and before Bilotti 1, and of course long before Bilotti 2. It was passed in 74 and challenged in this case in 1978. A particular emphasis that I would like to give just in summary to this case is that the state of Utah has chosen in this sensitive area to keep the state and its mechanisms, its agencies, and everyone else far removed from the decision-making process. It has seen this problem as being one to be handled within the family context, and that's why I see this case as an important case involving what the limits of family participation are, what the rights of a family as a unit are. The appellant has painted a picture of many adverse consequences that might come to a young lady seeking an abortion if her parents were notified. The problem is that any of those adverse consequences come purely, if they come at all, which is not in the record, come as a matter of private action of parents. There is no state action involved. The state has no right to veto an abortion decision, much less does it have the right to delegate to someone else the right to veto an abortion decision. The state is not trying to do any of those things. The state is merely trying to encourage within the private sphere of action the maximum possible parental knowledge and participation if that is permitted by the doctor.
Was that always true in the state of Utah prior to 1973?
No, I believe Utah had requirements prior to 1973 that were controlled and invalidated by this court's 1973 decisions.
So that what you've just said didn't apply to Utah prior to Roe against Wade?
No.
Dolomitz, do you have anything further?
I do, Your Honor. Wanted to point out to the court, briefly as a matter of history, the statute actually was adopted in 75. The statute adopted in 74 was declared unconstitutional by a three-judge federal court. Appeal was taken to this court. It was dismissed when this statute was adopted in 75. It was challenged within a few weeks of being adopted. The federal court found it very vague and abstained. That was appealed to the Tenth Circuit, who affirmed the abstention decision. This case was filed in 77 as a result. So there's been a series of challenges to this that spread out over the years. Then I wanted to point out from the questions of Mr. Justice Stewart and Mr. Justice Stevens that we're talking about the mature minor or emancipated minor. None of those exist in the statute. This statute is on its face. And Mr. Justice Stewart, you asked, and I didn't fully respond, about emancipation clearing. Emancipation, in terms of moving out of the house, no. In terms of marriage, yes. But Utah doesn't have the emancipated minor. Mr. Tinker gave his opinion, but that isn't even in the Attorney General's office opinion. That's his personal opinion that's come about. And the problem is this statute says all minors.
Well, I understand in Utah once a woman is married, whatever her age, she is no longer a minor.
That's a question I'm discussing. We do not have a clear answer. It says the statute said she gains her majority. But in terms of the question I was asked, what happens if she's 16, marries someone who's 16, and you send notice to the 16-year-old husband is now required? Okay. If 3 weeks later they get a divorce, it's determined that the marriage was a mistake.
Well, we don't have that case.
We don't know. We don't. But the problem is that this statute says you notify the parents in all women, including in this case. Let's say there's that 16-year-old, if there's a divorce, and she now suddenly finds out she's pregnant 3 or 4 weeks later, who do you notify? The statute says her parents.
We don't need to worry about that problem now, do we?
I think, Mr. Justice Berger, you do. And the reason I say that is because this statute says all parents. There's no distinction, and it says it.
But if marriage emancipates a minor woman, divorce does not probably
Utah law isn't clear on that point. I can't give you an answer on that. And picking up on...
I think you lose a lot of weight when you talk about divorces, Professor. Why don't you talk about annulments?
Okay, that's also possible. I would accept that.
Doesn't all of this add up to making some sense of the idea that we have not applied the overbreadth doctrine except in cases dealing with free speech generally as a matter of standing?
I think in this case that it must be done in overbreadth because that's what was done. And the questions that you've asked first me and then Mr. Tinker have demonstrated how overbroad this statute is. Remember, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that the Utah Supreme Court, between the time this was argued to Judge Winder, who had before him only the lower court decision in Bilotti, and the Utah Supreme Court decision, this court rendered its the Bilotti II decision. And that case was argued by me twice to the Utah Supreme Court, because after this court enunciated that decision, I filed a motion with the Utah Supreme Court for an intermediate injunction enjoining the statute and argued many of the points that we've covered today. They denied it, said they would defer it, set us on an early calendar. Mr. Tinker and I argued it again. They had it. They knew about the problems of the mature minor. But they didn't exempt the mature minor. They knew about the discussion in terms of best interest.
You were free also to go to the circuit justice and ask for the same relief, were you not?
At that point, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that's true, but I had staring at me a Tenth Circuit decision saying that the trial court was correct in abstaining because the statute was vague, because the Utah Supreme Court hadn't said what that language, if possible, meant, and I didn't have a ruling until when the decision came out in March of this year. It was at that time that we had a definition as to what the statute was, and instead of doing that, further cases were filed in the federal district court because we finally had an interpretation of what the language, if possible, meant.
Mr. Dulowitz, do you agree with the answer to Mr. Justice Brennan's question that if 10 minutes before performing the abortion, the doctor called up the parents and said, I'm about to abort your daughter, I want to give you notice in compliance with the statute, does so and then aborts it, there would be no danger to interference with the... I mean, there would be no violation of the statute if he went ahead, and there would be no terrible danger that he couldn't...
I do agree with Mr. Tinker that would be compliance with the statute, which is what shows that
if it's that easy to comply with it, how can you seriously argue that it substantially burdens the woman's right to choose the decision?
Because if the reason that he did that is that he knew, for example, that the parents were unbalanced and she risked physical injury when they found out, that injury risk is still waiting for her when she gets home, if she gets home, or when she next meets her parents, if she's afraid to go home. They can still hurt her.
So you'd say it would be equally unconstitutional if there was a requirement that 2 hours after an abortion is performed, they notify the parent because they might be unhappy
about
it.
Yes, it is still too overbroad.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.